You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business by Alex Ferrari. For a free copy of the audiobook, head over to www.filmbizbook.com.
The Director Series is made possible by the support of our subscribers on Special. Subscribe today at special.tv/The Director Series and gain access to exclusive full-length Director Series episodes and other bonus content, ad-free.
Welcome to the Director Series podcast, a show dedicated to deconstructing the work of some of cinema's most celebrated and influential film directors. I'm your host, Cameron Bile.
Aspiring directors making their first features under scrappy, shoestring budgets is a grand tradition within the art of cinema. Oftentimes, directors' first films are their most electrifying. Scorsese, Coppola, Cassavetes, Lynch, Malick, any major director born after World War II that you could think of, odds are they have a scrappy, rough-around-the-edges feature at the beginning of their filmographies. All of those films, and their maverick makers, owe a debt of gratitude to what could perhaps be considered the original indie debut, Kubrick's Fear and Desire.
There is war in this forest. Not a war that has been fought, or one that will be, but any war. And the enemies who struggle here do not exist unless we call them into being. This forest then, and all that happens now, is outside history. Only the unchanging shapes of fear and doubt and death are from our world.
Set in an unnamed country during an unnamed conflict, Fear and Desire uses the generic idea of combat to better access its psychological undercurrents as it tells the story of a small squadron of four men who must find their way back home after crash landing behind enemy lines. Just 25 years old at the time, Kubrick quit his job as a photographer at Look magazine to focus on the project full-time, acquiring the financing when his father cashed in his life insurance policy and his uncle chipped in some earnings from his pharmaceutical business. Kubrick recruited Howard Sackler, a high school classmate and aspiring poet, to write the screenplay. Kubrick shot the film silently as a way to stretch his meager $13,000 budget, but he hadn't planned on the expensive necessity of redubbing the actors' lines in a studio. Kubrick's cast is comprised mainly of unknowns, headed up by Kenneth Harp and Frank Silvera. Harp is styled in the vein of the traditional romantic hero archetype common in mid-century American cinema, confident and virtuous, but ultimately quite vanilla and devoid of any sort of edge. Silvera plays another large archetype, the gruff and tough military man, disgruntled by his long experience in the armed forces. Paul Mazursky, who would later go on to become a film director in his own right, plays a squirrely young recruit who is so affected by his transgressions against a local native girl that he ultimately goes mad, calling to mind shades of the Renfield character in Dracula.
Rats! Thousands! Millions of them!
In a move befitting a shoestring budget indie feature, Kubrick performed most of the duties of a film crew himself, with only his wife, Toba Metz, serving as script supervisor, Herbert Lebowitz working as the production designer, and a crew of Mexican day laborers acting as impromptu grips. Kubrick also served as his own cinematographer and editor, shooting the film in black and white, mostly for budgetary reasons, but also because he could maximize his experience in lighting for black and white photography so as to achieve more of a professional look. Kubrick and company shot in Southern California's San Gabriel Mountains, with the lack of conventional resources severely limiting their shooting style. Special effects were improvised, with equipment like a crop sprayer for smoke and fog, which naturally made the cast and crew violently ill, or repurposing a baby carriage as a dolly. Kubrick's eye, for the most part, is quite competent and is able to recognize compelling framing here. However, it's evident that the young filmmaker hadn't quite grasped the concept of eyelines and spatial geometry. This translates to a rather jarring and incoherent edit, where Kubrick routinely cuts away to close-ups that are framed in awkward angles or brazenly cross the 180-degree line.
It's better. It's better to roll up your life into one night and one man and one gun. It hurts too much to keep hurting everyone else in every direction.
When combined with a thick layer of overwrought, existential voiceover that tries hard at sounding profound, only to come off as hackneyed and trite, it's easy to see why Kubrick would strive so hard to keep Fear and Desire from being seen by mass audiences.
And nobody alive can tell which is which.
Violence and sex, admittedly, are two polar extremes in the spectrum of human experience, and two of the most potent, uncontrollable forces we will experience in our own lifetimes. Fear and Desire serves as our first true taste into Kubrick's mentality towards those two forces. The violence in Fear and Desire is rather surface level, but Kubrick films it in a particularly expressionistic way. One memorable instance occurs halfway through the film when the squadron storms a small guard outpost and kills the guard within. Instead of showing us the explicit act of a knife sliding into the belly of a hapless soldier, Kubrick shows us an extreme close-up of the orange the soldier had been eating prior to being unexpectedly ambushed. His fist squeezes the orange ever tighter until it bursts, spilling juice all over his hand and the floor. Frankly, it's hard to think of a more graceful and fitting way to communicate the traumatic explosion of a soul as it's extinguished against its will. Fear and Desire explores sexuality during the sequence where the squadron ties a native girl to a tree so that she won't give away the presence to the enemy. Kubrick makes his audience complicit with the squadron's most primitive instincts and desires by repeatedly cutting to close-ups of the girl's lips, eyes, hands, etc. Kubrick casts each body in the harsh light of the male gaze, and it is this same sexuality that the girl uses to free herself from her bonds and make her ill-fitted escape.
Come back! Don't tell the general! I wouldn't hurt you!
The consequences of this development cause Paul Mazursky's Private Sidney to lose himself in the grips of madness, yet another big theme present throughout Kubrick's work. Dehumanization and mankind's mental frailty against forces that are much larger than them, forces which are more often than not supernatural in origin. In Fear and Desire, for instance, the squadron encounters their lookalikes at the enemy base, which references the folklore of doppelgangers. The subsequent murder of their lookalikes at their own hands throws the surviving members of the squadron into an existential funk at the end of the film, where they ruminate on the true cost of warfare and whether they can ever truly bring themselves back from the brink they experienced behind enemy lines.
Come on, let's go.
As Kubrick developed as an artist, he came to see Fear and Desire as an embarrassment, denouncing it as such in public interviews and burying any possibility of further public screenings by burning the negative. For decades, Fear and Desire was touted as Kubrick's lost film, and the only way to see it was via the Kubrick estate, or, more recently, a poor-quality VHS bootleg with Italian subtitles uploaded to YouTube. Thankfully for us, and unfortunately for Kubrick, a print was found recently in the George Eastman Kodak archives and restored to its original glory, released publicly through Kino Lorber and the Library of Congress. While the ethics of going against the wishes of a deceased filmmaker is another conversation unto itself, Fear and Desire is nonetheless an important document in the history of cinema that should be preserved. The release of Fear and Desire came amid a tumultuous period of Kubrick's life. He had divorced Toba Metz shortly after production wrapped, and by this point had remarried to an Austrian-born dancer and theatrical designer named Ruth Sobotka. The finished feature was well received by critics of the day, who offered much more generous praise than the film probably deserved, but it fell far short in what the industry considers true success, box office. While Kubrick gained a good deal of new friends in the critics circle, his phone wasn't exactly ringing off the hook with calls from Hollywood. For him, there was no turning back. He was now committed as a full-time filmmaker, and until he found success in that line of work, he would have to put food on the table with commissioned work instead.
Thank you for listening to the Director Series. For a deeper dive into your favorite filmmakers, go to www.directorseries.net. The Director Series is made possible in large part by our generous supporters on Patreon. Please visit us at patreon.com/directorseries to see how your contribution enables the continued production of video essays and text articles on your favorite contemporary and classic film directors. Thank you.